She won't match
40. So, welcome. This is the fifth seminar in the Unconscious Memory Network series. On behalf of those of you who don't know me, I'm the organiser. And today's topic is Proustian memory. All throughout the year, we've been looking, trying to reduce the conceptual gap between mind and brain. And today is a very crowd-pleasing topic, which is on Proust and neuroscience. You already have, you probably know the books, Proust is a Neuroscientist and Proust and the Squid, perhaps. But one of the earliest articles which was published on this very topic was by our speakers today, called Madeleines and Neuromodernism, which came out in 1998. Kirsten has kindly produced, brought with her some copies if you'd like one at the end of the seminar. So they're going to speak together, and I'll just first introduce Professor Gordon Shepherd, who is Professor of Neurobiology at Yale Medical School, where he also served as a Deputy Provost. He's a pioneer in the neuroanalysis of the olfactory system, and he introduced to the field terms like brain microcircuits, dendritic synapses, and neurogastronomy. He also developed new fields of computational neuroscience and neuroinformatics, and his books, The Synaptic Organization of the Brain and Neurobiology, are used widely all over the world as textbooks. He's been the chief editor of the Journal of Neurophysiology and the Journal of Neuroscience. He's also a father of his collaborator today, Professor Kirsten Shepherd Barr, who our own Professor Shepherd Barr, who is in the on the Faculty of English here, where she specialises in modern drama. Her book, Theatre and Evolution from Ibsen to Beckett, was published this year by Columbia University Press. She's the author of a groundbreaking book called Science on the Stage, published by the Princeton University Press. I think we just about have seats. Yes? Yes. Maybe this one? Yeah, I suppose. Which I would highly recommend. And she's also author of Ibsen and the Early Modernist Theatre. She's the current knowledge exchange and public engagement champion for the humanities at Oxford. Please join me in welcoming our speakers today.
Thank you very much. May I turn it over to my collaborator? No, really, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. Kirsten and I will attempt to give you a follow-up to the article we wrote many years ago, in which it seemed there was an opportunity to bring together an analysis of a literary described episode and the neuroscience that could give insight into that episode. And so it gave the opportunity to address some of the interpretations by the author himself and by critics of this famous episode of the Madeleines and memory, and to show how neuroscience can provide insights that have relevance to events that are described in literature. And so it really is a cross-cultural opportunity. And so we invite all of you to join with us. And of course, we regard this entirely as an experiment. We are not Proustians. We were only drawn to this episode as an opportunity. And so we hope to learn as much from the discussion with all of you as we hope we can communicate to you. So please take it from there.
Yes, so we're going to go through this in four parts. So I will start and we'll actually just analyze the moment. We just want to look at the moment, the famous moment, and go through it in some detail, and then I'll hand over to Gordon and then he'll hand back and it'll be like ping pong. But we will try to do it in an integrated way. So I'll lead off with this episode.
Should we start part one?
Yeah, part one.
There we are.
Great.
Part one, analysis of the moment.
Which, let's see, should we start with the quote? Here we go. So here's one of the famous bits of it. But when, from a long distant past, nothing subsists after the people are dead, after the things are broken and scattered, taste and smell alone, more fragile but more enduring, more unsubstantial, more persistent, more faithful, remain poised a long time like souls, remembering, waiting, hoping amid the ruins of all the rest, and bear unflinchingly in the tiny and almost impalpable drop of their essence the vast structure of recollection. So this is the iconic moment that's really become a literary cliche. It's used, very often you'll see it in the media, used to indicate instantaneous and intense memory. We come across it all the time. But its precise nature, we feel, has been misunderstood. So there are 3 points about that. This is not, in fact, an instance of involuntary memory, but a combination of involuntary and voluntary recall. And the second thing is the trigger is as much smell as taste. Smell is the most important component of flavor, as you will be hearing. And Proust recognizes this, yet popular references to the Madeleine episode usually assume that the trigger is taste alone, or it's characterized in that way. And thirdly, the memory does not emerge right away, all of a sudden, but is delayed, and in fact requires quite a bit of conscious effort. Proust's famous statement that Combray emerged from my teacup in fact comes at the end of a long process of recall. So let's analyze his description of what happened. We won't be looking at the full passage as it takes several pages, which is part of our point, but let's go through the key moments. So to begin with, he shows that certain very specific conditions need to be in place in order for involuntary memory to occur. We're actually getting ahead of ourselves. One is that the narrator is in a depressed, dejected state. His word is oppressed by the gloomy weather and the sad future he envisions. And the second thing is, although he is doing something that is habitual, in that it's a physical act he does all the time of in taking food in his mouth, he doesn't normally drink tea, and he makes that point in the passage. So the circumstances are out of the ordinary for him. So while the action itself is an ordinary thing that you do all the time and he's done all the time, the circumstances are unusual. And the other thing is that a final condition is that the memory that eventually emerges must have been a forgotten one. It was forgotten, it's totally unexpected, has not been thought about for years and years. And now we're on to the second quotation. Yeah, so, but was it an involuntary memory then? And so Proust's text says otherwise. So here's the long bit. I begin again to ask myself what it could have been, this unremembered state. I decide to attempt to make it reappear. I retrace my thoughts to the moment at which I drank the first spoonful of tea. I rediscover the same state. I ask my mind to make one further effort to bring back once more the fleeting sensation. I shut out every obstacle. I compel it, my mind, for a change to enjoy the distraction which I have just denied it. For the second time, I clear an empty space in front of it. I place in position before my mind's eye the still recent taste of that first mouthful, and I feel something start within me. I do not know yet what it is, but I can feel it mounting slowly. Undoubtedly, what is thus palpitating in the depths of my being must be the image, the visual memory, which, being linked to that taste, is trying to follow it into my conscious mind. 10 times over, I must essay the task. And suddenly the memory revealed itself, is how that ends. So he shows a very specific sequence of events. One is that the sensory stimulus first triggers an intense emotional state, so elation, joy, happiness, and then the specific memory. Now, let's see, I think quotation.
Do we want the next one?
I think possibly. Yeah, so here we go. The emotions evoked by the Madeleine are crucial to the whole theoretical edifice of critical thought on this episode. He goes on to say, an exquisite pleasure had invaded my senses. So the emotion is described as this exquisite pleasure. Something isolated, detached, with no suggestion of its origin. This new sensation had the effect which love has of filling me with a precious essence. Whence could it have come to me, this all-powerful joy? I sense that it was connected with the taste of the tea and cake, but that it was infinitely transcended those savors, could not indeed be of the same nature. Whence did it come? What did it mean? How could I seize and apprehend it? And so this emotional state defies mortality. It's so transcendent. He says, I ceased to feel I was mediocre, contingent, mortal. The narrator attempts to understand it. He asks, where did it come from? What did it mean? How could I grasp it? And so he tries to prolong it by drinking a second mouthful, but immediately the sensation starts to lessen, and this is desensitization occurring. And we've all felt this when you have a very powerful trigger and then you attempt to enjoy it, and then after a while it sort of wanes. And this can also be an unpleasant smell, for instance, that you sort of, it lessens as time goes on. So this sensory adaptation takes place, and it gets in the way of him hanging on to the experience. But he's determined to make the emotional state reappear, as he says, and note that so far no mention has yet been made of Cambrai. A memory has not yet emerged in a tangible way. By conscious and creative effort, and the emphasis here is on creative effort, so he's clearing his mind, he's concentrating, he's ignoring extraneous sounds and sights, he is able to call something forth, something, quote, quivering, but still indistinct. And he often uses this term create in this section. Something is trying to struggle up from, quote, my very depths, but, quote, I no longer feel anything, so 10 times over, I must begin again. So just when he's about to give up and resign himself to losing that moment forever, to never knowing what it was that was trying to struggle forth from his unconscious, suddenly the memory appeared, he says. His aunt giving him a bit of her tea-soaked Madeleine as a child in Cambrai. Only once this specific place is located does the full memory flood over him. Immediately, the old gray house on the street emerges, the town, the square, the streets, the gardens, the people, all of this, which is assuming form and substance, emerged from my cup of tea. So to conclude this little first section here, there are some things about this episode to note. There's a paradox in that the extraordinary state is brought about by a completely ordinary act and recalls a memory that is likewise unremarkable. It's only remarkable to the individual. The episode gets at the essence of being a writer. In Time Regained, he says that the moment of tasting the Madeleine is in and of itself insignificant. The significance has to be extracted. And so here he links the Madeleine episode to his larger aesthetic project, saying that it is through this process of extraction that the writer arrives finally at, quote, real life, and, quote, real life is literature. And finally, Proust recognizes at once that it is a combination of taste and smell that generates this intense emotional state, as he calls them soul's remembering. And this is where we go over to you.
Oh, I was finding this quite interesting. So so maybe we'll hold off then any discussion points until I've shown you what neuroscience is all about and how it might give insight into this episode, and then we can begin to encourage you to join in. So what about the science of this literary moment? So we're going to be concerned with the brain, because all of our experience is actually, even though stimulated by our environment, is created for ourselves by our brain. And this first really came home to me when I got increasingly interested in flavor. And flavor is actually the core of the Madeleine incident, because he's describing a flavor. He calls it a taste. He also includes smell. And when we wrote our original article, we pretty much kept those, regarded those as separate compartments. but in the meantime, it's become obvious to those of us working on smell and taste that what we're really talking about is flavor. And flavor is a combination of all of the senses involved in our appreciation, our perception of the food or drink that we take into our mouths. And the first key thing that we all want to recognize is that flavor is not in the food. Flavor is created by the brain. And so it's very similar in that sense, in that way, to color, because color isn't in the objects that we see having color around us. Color is created from the different wavelengths that are bouncing off all of us, and is created as a perception to inform and elaborate on our experience of the visual world around us. We have an expert on the visual system among us, and so we will be able to consult with him if we need more light thrown on this aspect. But flavor then...
It'll be a colored light.
Pardon?
It'll be a colored light.
A colored light, there you are. Created out of wavelengths. So in the same way, the Madeleine, the sense, the perception that we refer to Proust or to Marcel or who is
call
it?
Call Marcel.
Should we call it Marcel? All right, that Marcel has is not in the Madeleine, but it's the flavor that's created by his brain. And what about that brain? So if we are talking only about the sense of smell, then we have that occurs by orthonasal inspiration of the air to bring in what's outside in the Madeleine before we consume it, that stimulates the olfactory cells in the top of the nasal cavity. They send their fibers to the olfactory bulb, which forms a spatial pattern representing those molecules. I'm going to spare you all of the circuits and dynamics that we have carried out and many others over the years, just to say that a pattern is created. We actually call it an odor image, a smell image, a pattern that represents those different molecules. And so it's created entirely by the brain in order that the brain can then process that information as a pattern, just as the visual system takes a pattern of stimulation of the retina and projects that further to the brain for processing. And it next goes to the olfactory cortex, where further processing takes place, so that instead of an image of the sensory input, an image that is in terms of the language of the brain is created, and we call this a smell object or an odor object, because now it's in a form that the brain can use to send it on to other parts of the brain. And so in the case of just the sense of smell, it goes to the highest level of perception in the prefrontal cortex, in what is called the orbital frontal cortex, medial and lateral. So that's the stimulation of the olfactory part of the brain, and from that we get a perception of a smell. However, we're dealing in this case, and in all cases in which we consume something so that it's inside our mouths, with a different kind of stimulation of the olfactory system. And this happens when we breathe out, so that the volatiles that are released from what is in our mouth, and it's shown here as a piece of food, but it could be just the fluid, or it could be a very small biscuit, as in the case of the Madeleine, a small cake. But within the mouth, then volatiles are released as we digest, as we manipulate the food in our mouths, so that they're caught by the breathing out. You can imagine yourself. You breathe out, and that carries the volatiles again into the nasal cavity to stimulate the olfactory receptor cells, and the whole process in the olfactory system is repeated. But now there's an enormous difference, because not only is the olfactory system activated, but every other sensory system in the brain. So the touch system is activated by the touch of the madeleine in the mouth and the tea. The taste system, the taste buds in the on the tongue and further back activate the taste system, and so the touch system sends its fibers up to the somatosensory part of the cerebral cortex. The taste system sends its fibers up to the taste part of the cerebral cortex. The visual system has already been activated by seeing the madeleine as it's taken and put in the mouth, and the cup of tea, and we'll see how important vision is as well. And even the auditory system is activated as you slosh around the tea in your mouth and crunch the madeleine. And just think about how important Rice Krispies, crunching is to selling Rice Krispies. And so now we're getting into understanding what it is that makes a particular food or a beverage attractive. And so now you see we're stimulating quite a bit of the brain, and this is only sensory discrimination. Now we'd have to recognize that the motor system in our heads is also being activated. We never have, flavor is never a passive sense, it's always an active sense. So when we take something in our mouths, we have to move our mouths and begin to use our tongues to manipulate the food or our liquid. So this is what we call an active sense, or active touch. And it's completely different from looking straight forward and seeing somebody and activating only the visual system until we start to examine that person more and be more actively involved. And now I haven't even talked about what was so important for Proust, and that was all the emotions. So first, and the memory. So first of all, there are memory systems then that are activated, and I can't even show them. I'll show you them in the animation. But there are memory systems involving the hippocampus and others. There are emotional systems that are connected particularly to the olfactory, the smell system, that are aroused by different kinds of stimuli and the experience of them. There are all the systems involved in motivation. Usually we are motivated when we're hungry. We're motivated when we see something that we really like. It's a little different with Proust, because he's not motivated to do anything. And so it's only his aunt who provides him with something that then stimulates his motivation. And so all that effort to bring forth that unremembered memory involves the motivational systems. And these are tremendously important in human and animal life. There are reward systems that involve the transmitter called dopamine, that are systems that are activated when we achieve the consummation of something that we feel is rewarding. And so the reward systems obviously flooded Marcel as he consumed and then found the final goal of the memory. And finally, there are the language systems. So Proust could never have described this incident without it connecting to the language systems in a way that enabled him to explain an emotion that might not be closely related to. Emotions are not necessarily connected to our language systems without some effort. And so, and I believe there are passages that relate to how difficult it was to express in words the emotions that were called forward. And so that emphasizes how important language is to the human experience of memory and emotion and all the other things. So that's an introduction to just the most superficial view of the brain systems that are involved. And now I'm going to show you an animation that puts them into a sequence. It seemed to me that seeing this still view of the brain and the head and everything going on here with the consuming the a morsel of food didn't really give you the full insight into how complex this series of movements and sensations and emotions are. And so I thought an animation would help to do that. So let's go to how the brain creates flavor from food. So this whole thing is what I call neurogastronomy because it amplifies our view of gastronomy, which is the pleasure we get from the food we eat. And the brain is so central to the experience that it's an attempt to give you this more enlarged view. And so I'm going to play this now, and you can listen to it, and then I'll interrupt it from time to time.
First, the cephalic phase. Eating actually begins when we start to think about food and flavors using our highest brain centers, especially the prefrontal cortex. We may shop for the food, prepare it, or sit down at a restaurant. Seeing food and sensing the aromas activate our dopamine reward system. Like Pavlov's dogs, autonomic centers for salivation begin to be active.
So this is all in terms, I don't have an animation for just for the Proustian incident. But this, it gives you the larger context of when we are preparing to eat. And this is, of course, lacking in the case of the Proust incident, because he's very depressed and he's not thinking about food. And so that forms an interesting contrast with the way the system usually works.
We feel hunger due to hormones controlled by the hypothalamus, which activate motivation centers in the brain to want to eat. This cephalic phase thus involves the critical balance between our expectations of flavor, nutrition, and amount, inhibitory restraint by control centers in our frontal lobes, stimulation by our senses and our systems for emotions, memories, and reward, and influences from others through our language centers.
So these larger systems here involving emotion, memory, and reward and so forth are obviously in a different state for Marcel as he's fed the tea. And so this is I think an interesting variation on the normal way that the system usually gets activated.
This balance determines eating a flavorful and healthy diet, avoiding obesity and related disorders. Next, preliminary analysis. The food is served and the motor systems of our arms, hands, and fingers select a bite. We use our eye muscles and visual perception to check out its appearance and breathe in the aroma by orthonasal smell. Autonomic pathways produce saliva. Next, ingestion. Our prefrontal cortex system decides to...
So the orthonasal is the breathing in. I'm not sure, I want to catch
it. To ingest the food. We move the food to the mouth, inhale.
So this is orthonasal. smell when we're breathing in and sensing the smell of what we're about to eat. And that would be what Marcel first sensed as he took the...
...for a final test of the aroma, and the prefrontal cortex decides to ingest the food. The jaw opens, the tongue is placed to receive the food.
So there are those little white dots, the volatile molecules from the madeleine.
And we take a bite. The initial analysis. The ingested food immediately activates touch receptors in the mouth, and the signals arise to the cortex.
So these are the touch receptors here, and the touch pathway going up through the thalamus. And when it reaches the cortex then, we believe that's where consciousness begins.
Cortex for touch perception. Perception of the food and its flavors all refer to the mouth as, quotes, taste. The motor system for chewing commences coordinated with breathing. The food begins to stimulate the taste buds, activating the taste pathway for conscious perception of taste qualities, sweet, salt, sour, bitter, and umami. The tongue moves the food to stimulate all the taste buds and pushes it to the teeth for mastication. The lips close, volatiles are released, exhalate.
So here are the volatiles released from the madeleine that are now going to go up and back through the... You have no idea how hard it was for the artist to make those little white balls.
...mastication occurs and retronasal smell begins. The dopamine reward system responds to the sensory stimuli. The salivary glands secrete their enzymes.
So here's something we're not aware of, and that is that at the back of the mouth, our soft palate is open, leaving it open for the volatiles to go back through the nasopharynx and up into the nasal cavity. And in the same way, we're breathing through our trachea, and so we're holding all of this in our mouths, enabling this air to go back and forth, particularly upward and back, so that we can smell what's in our mouths. And of this, we're totally unaware. And that's something we'll come back to again and again.
Chewing vibrations activate the auditory pathway to give perception of sounds, such as crunchiness, that are important in judging the quality and flavor of the food. Next, forming the perceptual image. We're not aware that what we call taste is usually due mostly to retronasal smell. A better term is therefore flavor. It arises as a unified perceptual image as the association cortical areas process and relay this information to the prefrontal and orbitofrontal cortex.
So these are the association areas around the primary areas, and as soon as all of the sensory systems begin to be stimulated together, they communicate to enlarge the activation of the cortex to these association areas, which give us the elaboration of the perception. And so all of this is going on in Marcel's brain without him realizing it.
Repeated chewing produces a mash mixed with saliva. The movements of the tongue in manipulating the food are complex, more complex, actually, than tongue movements during speech.
That's one of the most interesting things I found in this whole study, and that is we would think that the tongue movements we use in speech are highly refined and evolved during human evolution. But it turns out from studies of comparing tongue movements in manipulation of food and tongue movements in speech, that it's the tongue movements manipulating the food in our mouths that are more complex and are the basis then for what was used then by the body to generate the vowels and the consonants.
During chewing, the retronasal pathway is open so the volatiles from the back of the mouth ascend during exhalation to stimulate the smell receptors in the nose. Next, analyzing the perceptual object. Memory systems are engaged, telling us that the food is what I like, what I want.
So here are all the systems now that I mentioned before. Many of them during normal eating are already activated as we think about the food we're going to eat in that cephalic phase. But now they get stimulated by what's actually in the mouth.
Want or what I crave. Emotion systems tell us that this food makes me happy or unhappy.
Well, it definitely is making Marcel happy.
Discrimination systems tell us how this compares with what I expected and with other flavors. The dopamine reward system is activated to prefer or reject the food. Language systems enable us to communicate our judgments around the table using words. During chewing, we're not aware that when we inhale, the food in our mouths does not activate the smell receptors, nor are we aware that when we exhale, we...
So, when exhale, again, we're totally unaware that the most of the flavor is coming from the activation of the olfactory sensory cells here. Most of us think that the flavor and the smell, the flavor we associate with the smell, is coming from the mouth, because that's where the food is, or that's where the madeleine is, and the tea. And this is why talking about the taste of a food is so confusing, and that's why Marcel is referring to it as well.
Add retronasal smell to the flavor. As chewing proceeds, the mash becomes a mesh in which the individual food elements become fused to produce a continuous perception of a flavor object. Next, swallowing. When the mesh is judged by the prefrontal cortex system to be ready, the decision is made to swallow, the final critical step in taking this foreign substance into the body. The tongue moves the mesh to the back of the mouth. The prefrontal cortex wills the takeover of the mesh to the swallowing center, which acts automatically. Swallowing closes the nasopharynx and the epiglottis.
So, there's the uvula, there is the epiglottis closing off, so there's no more breathing, so that the swallowing can take place without choking or without it going up into the nasal cavity. But of this also, we're totally unaware. The sensation of flavor continues without us realizing it's been momentarily interrupted.
To prevent the food from going up into the nose and down into the trachea, and activates the muscles of the tongue and pharynx to push the mesh through the back of the mouth and into the esophagus. Finally, post-swallowing. When swallowing is finished, the muscles of the uvula and epiglottis relax, breathing resumes, and if we pay attention, we're aware of a heightened flavor left over from the food in the mouth and the resumption of retronasal smell. Finally, the dopamine reward system signals the value of the food consumed, and the relative desirability of the food is learned and remembered through synaptic plasticity. When hunger changes to satiation, motivation and emotion systems change to rejection, and the prefrontal control system decides to stop eating. Post-ingestive effects throughout the gut and body condition us for the next meal. In this most complex of human behavioral systems, all of the subsystems must be in balance for healthy eating to occur.
And for recollection of unremembered memories. So this is the system that is at work during this incident of unremembered memories. And so, again, the key, I think, take-home message is that all of this is creating the sensation from the madeleine. The madeleine is only the source of the molecules that then the brain works on, that the key here is that all of this is taking place then in as the basis for the effort that Proust then puts forth in order to recall an unremembered memory. And so we can go back now to the text and ask how this might relate to some of the criticism and interpretation that's been raised.
Okay. Because we kind of, our basic idea is we think Proust was onto this. We think without necessarily having had any insights like this, obviously, there's a sense that the text is conveying something beyond an ordinary understanding of just, oh, the food is causing this. There's a sense that he really is aware of some other mechanism going on, and he's trying to ascertain what it is and trying to define it.
Oh, here, I have one last slide.
Oh, yeah.
So here are the different levels at which we work in neuroscience to uncover the basis, the neural basis, of a particular behavior, in this case, of a very unhappy person coming in to treat. And we can, with understanding what happens, see how why he gets so happy eventually. So that was the animation, and now the literary impact. Go ahead.
So we thought maybe look a bit at the context, the wider context, because he wasn't alone in seeing these kinds of moments as really significant and trying to pin them down. So his fellow modernists were busy with similar ideas. So James Joyce, Catherine Mansfield, Virginia Woolf were all bent on capturing the elusive yet meaningful moments that make up who we are. Because this is so important to Marcel as part of his identity. And he keeps using this term essence. And I think it's very connected to the notion of identity. Joyce called these moments epiphanies. For Woolf, they were moments of being. Both Joyce and Proust see such moments as quasi-religious. These regained memories generate emotional states that seem to defy mortality, erase the fear of death, make life worth living. And all of this, of course, is elaborated in other moments throughout Time Regained. The other modernist I wanted to talk about is Samuel Beckett, who made a famous study of Proust as a very young man in 1931, in which he seems to agree that the sudden, overwhelming appearance of the memory is a miracle, that's his word, contingent upon a precise set of circumstances relating to the emotional state of the individual. So we have a big chunk of Beckett's treatise on Proust. No amount of voluntary manipulation, says Beckett, can reconstitute in its integrity an impression that the will has, so to speak, buckled into incoherence. But if by accident and given favorable circumstances, a relaxation of the subject's habit of thought and a reduction of the radius of his memory, a generally diminished tension of consciousness following upon a phase of extreme discouragement, if by some miracle of analogy the central impression of a past sensation recurs as an immediate stimulus which can be instinctively identified by the subject with the model of duplication whose integral purity has been retained because it has been forgotten, then the total past sensation, not its echo nor its copy, but the sensation itself, annihilating every spatial and temporal restriction, comes in a rush to engulf the subject in all the beauty of its infallible proportion. So he subscribed to Proust's idea about involuntary memories as, quote, sealed vessels, which is Beckett's term, which contain the essences of our true selves preserved intact, only accessible through involuntary recall. But the key idea here is that they're somehow preserved without being changed. Proust searches for such impressions that have, quote, as he says, the power to resuscitate the timeless man within me. And Beckett constantly uses terms like purity, integrity, the real. He seems to see the same moral and salvationist dimension to involuntary memory that Proust does. Aesthetically, despite their drastically different uses of language, the one profuse, the other quite sparing, one of the most interesting connections between Proust and Beckett is the ordinariness paradox I mentioned earlier. So the idea of habit really fascinated Beckett, as we know. I mean, Beckett's just looking at his plays, which is my area. They revolve around inconsequential acts, so taking off your boots, eating a carrot, standing and waiting. Famously, one critic, of course, said that nothing happens twice in Waiting for Godot. Just as in Time Regained hinges on everyday acts, what Proust calls little things, and both writers, in fact, focus more on states of being than on actions. Literature after Proust is full of such moments of finding the meaning in the seemingly insignificant everyday routine act and exploring his suggestion that of all human pursuits, the most important is trying to understand what we experience. To answer the question of, quote, what did it mean that he posed, we discussed earlier. Yet for all his insistence, he avoids dogmatism. He says that writers who propound aesthetic theories are guilty of a, quote, gross impropriety. He says, a work in which there are theories is like an object which still has its price tag on it. Writers after Beckett have continued to explore how memory works. For instance, and I'm picking another playwright, Brian Friel, who in plays like Dancing at Lunasa and Living Quarters has really explored and put on stage the workings of memory. In a diary entry, he expressed thoughts on the slipperiness of memory that unconsciously blend an accurate understanding of the neuroscience of memory and a nod toward Paul Ricoeur's ideas about the uncoupling of memory and imagination, I think. So here is his quotation from Brian Friel's diaries.
Whoops.
Oh, did we forget it? No? I think it's there. Next, maybe?
No. Oh? No, I don't think we got it in.
Okay, well, here it is. The fact is a fiction. Have I imagined the scene then? This is Friel writing. or is it a composite of two or three different episodes? The point is, I don't think it matters. What matters is that for some reason, this vivid memory is there in the storehouse of my mind. For some reason, the mind has shuffled the pieces of verifiable truth and composed a truth of its own. For me, it is a truth, and because I acknowledge its peculiar veracity, it becomes a layer in my subsoil. It becomes part of me. Ultimately, it becomes me. I think you're going to illuminate how that works. Is that right?
So I thought I'd end my part of the science in talking about how we recover a memory and bring it into consciousness. And I'm not going to be able to go into each of the systems in detail, but I'd like to try to put things in the context of the unconscious aspect of memory and as opposed to the conscious. So I've told you that the contribution of retronasal smell to flavor occurs without our being conscious of it. Is everybody clear on that? But that means that flavor is an illusion. And what we think is one of the most conscious perceptions we have in our lives, at least three times a day, and six or seven or eight, depending on how many cups of coffee we go around with during the day. It means that what we think is a clear fact, that there's a taste of things in our mouths, that the taste comes from what's in the thing we take into our mouths, and that it's all due to what the sensation from our mouths is an illusion. And I'm still impressed with this after having fully realized it from the co-workers and collaborators and colleagues in the field, that this is something that there is no way that you can really be aware of this. So the next meal you have, sit down and start eating and try to think of those volatiles coming from the back of the mouth, stimulating the nose, and having that referred to the mouth as what you're calling taste. And it just won't work. And so this whole edifice of flavor is something that contains unconscious contributions from smell. And so in that sense, our memory of flavor is an unconscious memory. This may be a question of semantics, but I think this would be fun to have as a discussion point. The second is, where was this memory lodged in the brain? Where was it actually present? We talk about memory traces, which is simply a word that describes that there must be something there that is actually there in order to be then recalled. And there's now enough work with brain imaging to address that. And one of the key points, I did want to indicate this, that the olfactory system has a particular prevalence in memory of because of the fact that all of the systems, the visual system, the touch system, and the auditory system, come into the back of the brain and have connections that then go forward to be integrated with the taste system, to be integrated with the smell system in the orbital frontal cortex, which then has close connections with the so-called limbic areas where memories and emotions that are essential to memories and emotions. And so the one reason that the episode of the Madeleine is is so strong in Proust's mind is that involves smell that has direct access to, remember I showed how his system is coming directly into the frontal part of the cortex. All of the other systems have to be referred to the frontal part. And so there's a lot of interest in where consciousness arises, usually focused on the visual system, and maybe Ray can comment on this. But in the olfactory system, in fact, we can go back to that. The olfactory system, remember, is only two synapses, only two relays away from these highest levels of the brain. And so that's one reason why our senses, our sense of smell and flavor is so immediate. And this is not even a part of the discussion yet of where consciousness arises in the brain, because most of the focus is on the visual system and on the other sensory systems. So that's a whole area that I think is going to be very interesting to explore. And then finally, I wanted to say that in the case of a memory like Combré, it's what we call multimodal. And that means that it consists of the visual recollection, it consisted of the smell of the tea, the taste of the tea, recollection of the probably the wind and the sounds of Combré. They all made this a multimodal memory. So the question arises, where are those different parts of the memory? Where are they retained in the brain? And the best evidence now, and I can go into this if you're interested, is that it's like the memory itself is like a gestalt, a whole perception, like a face actually, it has a gestalt to it, or a complex pattern. And it's a characteristic of a complex pattern that a small part of it can be enough to bring back the whole pattern. And so that, in a sense, is what happened with the recollection of Combré, is that he struggled with one part of it, the flavor, the smell, or the touch of the Madeleine, and what he was doing was trying to recreate the reconnection of all the different parts of the memory that involved vision and audition and touch and so forth. And finally, then the whole thing comes back. And I think we can sense that from our own experience, that a small part of a picture can bring back the whole part of the picture, and that's one of the essences of gestalt. It's in some studies in the brain, it's called a content addressable memory, that is, every part of a pattern contains some representation of the whole pattern. And so there's actually evidence from brain imaging of the activation of different parts of the brain related to the smell and to the vision and to the hearing related to the recollection of these multimodal memories. So that's maybe enough on the neuroscience. So it's time to get some input from all of you.
Can we just thank the speakers for that terrific talk? Thank you very much.